Please be seated. Good afternoon. This is our first argument, September 2008, first argument since, it was April when we had our last arguments and then worked on getting out opinions. And it's very unusual. Not only is it our first argument, but it's the only argument of the day, and we started in the afternoon. Nothing. We ought to continue doing that. Just one argument a day and started in the afternoon. So we want to welcome you all to the courtroom, and let me introduce the court, which is a new court, and therefore I'll have to watch and see where everybody is seated so I don't make a mistake. And on my far left is Justice Michael Gableman, a new addition to the bench, and this is his first oral argument. You are not allowed to ask him any questions. Seated next to Justice Gableman is Justice Patience Robinson. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. Referred to as David Foster. I'm Shirley Abrahams, Chief Justice. And to my right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And to her right, the real David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With that being the lineup on the court, we will now turn to the lineup at the council table. Our case is 08AP333-CQ, which means certified question, Plastics Engineering Company versus Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. And the parties have agreed and the court has approved the following. We will start out with certified question number 3. Mr. Sullivan will argue 15 minutes, Mr. Davis 20 minutes, and then Mr. Sullivan 5 minutes in rebuttal. We will then turn to certified questions 1 and 2 with Mr. Sullivan at 20 minutes, Mr. Davis at 25, and then Mr. Sullivan at 5 minutes. So we will begin with you, Attorney Sullivan, who will be introduced by Wisconsin licensed attorney Michael J. Cohn. Mr. Cohn. Thank you. Counsel, you're here for Beachy, and welcome.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Thank you for allowing me to appear to that.
Proceed, please.
May it please the court, my name is John Sullivan, and I represent Liberty Mutual. We're here today to address three certified issues that were accepted for certification by this
court. Counsel, I would suggest you move the podium up. There's a button on, where is it now? They've changed podiums on the right side, left side. Oh, it's, there we go. Thank you. I think that you'll be heard better. Thank you.
We're going to start with the third issue that was certified by this court, and that issue is whether the Wisconsin court should adopt an all-sums allocation approach or a pro-rata allocation approach to determining liability when an injury spans successive insurance policies.
I have one question that goes to all the certified questions. It strikes me that your briefs and arguments, at least as I understand them, looked at these cases from the perspective of Plastic Engineering and Liberty Mutual. And I never got the sense of what a holding of this court will mean to the individual person hurt. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? So if it's pro rata, my understanding is then the Liberty Mutual will pay less because it what didn't insure them for the entire time period. Right?
Correct.
If it's not pro rata, then Liberty Mutual will pay more because it will be treated as if there was no break in the policies.
Yes, what would happen under that approach?
That's the basic thing. What does it mean to me? I was injured. What does it mean to me?
I think what it means to the injured victim is the question of whether the money is ultimately coming from the insurance company or is coming from the tortfeasor who allegedly caused the injury. Now, that's what it means with respect to the injured victim today. What it may mean with respect to injured victims in the future is the question of whether or not the impact of this court's decision, that is, if this court were to accept Liberty Mutual's approach, which is to say that we should only pay for the liability based on bodily injury that occurs during our policy period. I think that the impact would be this, that if you're a company like Plenco, and you know that if you don't buy insurance, and bodily injury occurs during a period when you decided not to buy insurance, you're going to bear that economic responsibility. I think it increases the incentive for policyholders to buy insurance because they know that they're not going to be put in the position that all of the injury for which they're liable will be collapsed into a period where they had coverage, but instead they'll be on the hook for that liability. So I think that that's a positive impact of a decision that accepts the approach that we're advocating today. I also think that there's a positive impact in that, and I'm thinking of a decision from the Supreme Court of New Jersey. It's the Owens, Illinois case, which talks about the notion of looking at the signals that court decisions send to the insurance market and to the policyholder market. And I think that there's also a question that if you're an insurance company, and you're in the position that you know if you sell an insurance policy today to someone who is a manufacturer of products, that you may now, as a result of selling that policy for the year 2008, be responsible for injury that occurred for the last 20 years and injury that occurs for the next 20 years going out. I think it has two impacts. One is a reluctance to sell the coverage. And secondly, I think it has an impact on the price of the coverage.
Did that answer your question, Chief? Okay. I thought the question went to more how does it play out for the injured party? Maybe I'm wrong. That was my question, and I'm going to ask it for all these issues, by the way.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last comment.
I said I'm going to ask that question for all of the issues, all three issues, because it seems to me the whole focus here was between these two parties, and somehow the injured party got lost.
Oh, my name is Sam Smith, and I've been exposed to asbestos for several years during the relevant period of the policy.
Yes.
On issue number three, what difference does it make if we do pro rata or all sum?
I don't believe it makes any difference. It just determines where the money comes from.
It doesn't make a difference as long as both Liberty and Plastics are solvent. If they're not solvent, it does make a difference.
And I agree, Your Honor, that if Plastics was not solvent, it would have an impact on the ability to recover from Plastics.
Because Plastics is always going to be liable. The only issue is how much they get from their insurance company.
Yes, I think...
But assuming all the allegations are correct.
Yes, and I think the end result of any policy provision like this policy provision, and this is essentially we're talking about the coverage grants of the policy. The policy says we will pay all sums that the insured becomes legally obligated to pay as damages for bodily injury to which the policy applies. The policy applies to bodily injury that occurs during the period of time that there's only coverage if bodily injury occurs during a policy period. Here we have a situation where for 18 years, Plenco was selling, and Plastics Engineering is usually referred to as Plenco, was selling asbestos-containing products in the marketplace, and it wasn't buying insurance for those products specifically.
I thought that there was insurance in the primary policy for all the years at issue, that there were just a couple of years where there was umbrella coverage purchased from another carrier.
Your Honor, actually, if I can just go through maybe the history of the insurance purchases as I understand it.
Go ahead. I have a chart on it, but go ahead.
From 1950 until 1980, beginning in 1950, Plastics was selling asbestos-containing products. From 1950 until 1957, it didn't have any insurance with any company, primary or excess.
Are we dealing with that period in this case?
We are, and the reason that we're dealing with that period is that the complaints against Plenco allege that the plaintiffs were exposed to asbestos throughout the period of time that they were working with the asbestos, and that injury occurs immediately upon exposure to asbestos.
Okay, so, I mean, don't you have to have an expert testify to that in order to bring the injury within either the policy period or outside the policy period?
Well, Your Honor, I guess you would have two separate issues there. One, of course, is the allegations of the complaint are that the injury, and in this case, for example, we used an exemplar complaint as the basis for some of our discussion in the stipulated facts. The allegations of the complaint are that bodily injury occurs immediately upon exposure. We actually, in this case, I don't think that we would need an expert because Liberty Mutual and Plastics entered into a stipulated and agreed record in which we stipulated that, in fact, bodily injury occurs throughout the period of exposure to asbestos. And, Your Honor, it may be that you could get another toxic tort situation where there would be a different set of factors that I can't contemplate right now. But here, I don't think we needed expert testimony because we agreed that that's what happens. Now, Your Honor, and I wanted to get back to your question about the coverage. So 1950 to 1957, no coverage. 1957 until 1961, buying insurance from Liberty Mutual, but the policies it was buying did not cover products liability. From 1961 until 1968, it was buying coverage that provided products liability coverage for only one product, which is not the product that caused the injuries to the plaintiffs that are suing Plenco.
Mm-hmm.
Then, from 1968 until 1989, in the primary policies, they had products coverage every year with Liberty Mutual. And then in 1989, they still had coverage with Liberty Mutual, but the policies after 1989 all had asbestos exclusions. Then we have the excess layer, and Your Honor, in this case, we've only dealt with the Liberty Mutual excess policies, but there are other excess policies above Liberty Mutual. The first excess policy came into effect in May of 1970, and as of May of 1970, that policy would have provided products liability coverage. Liberty Mutual provided...
70 through 88, except for 1984 to 1986.
Correct. And during that period of time, there was a different excess carrier that was the insurer.
And let me just... Maybe you can straighten me out on this. I've been kind of looking at these year-by-year policies, which require an injury during the policy period in order to tap the policy as a trigger. I've been looking at it kind of like tail coverage for medical malpractice where the doc stopped practicing. He's not doing anything anymore, but he did something way back here, and it may cause an injury that's manifest during a policy period, which is long after he retires. Is there a difference between the policy here that we're looking at in regard to an injury that manifests itself after the conduct that is a cause of the injury?
I think there are a couple of differences, and one is, particularly at this time, lots of policies, and particularly medical malpractice policies, are written on a claims-made basis. And actually, and obviously this is not part of the record here, but what doctors typically do is if a doctor stops practice, they buy what is known as an extended tail or an extended reporting option coverage, which provides coverage to them for an injury that is the subject of the claim. Let's say a doctor retires in 2008. The claim comes in 2010, but it's based on malpractice that occurred, let's say, 2006. Those policies typically would provide coverage for the doctor as long as he had had insurance at the time of he committed the malpractice. It's a different situation in that just the nature of medical malpractice coverage generally.
Well, I guess what I was trying to straighten out in my own mind, as I looked at the definition and the policy of occurrence, it required conduct that caused an injury, and the injury had to fall within a policy period in order to give rise to coverage.
That's exactly right.
But it doesn't say that the conduct has to fall within the policy period. So you could do something 5 years ago, and the injury could show up today, and won't that fall within the policy? So I was kind of equating the old surgery that happened and somebody left a sponge in there and you don't know it until later on and then there's an injury and a claim made for that.
Yeah, the policies that are at issue in this case are policies in which the key is whether injury took place during the policy period. The question of when the negligence took place that may have resulted in injury later.
Doesn't matter
for purposes of how the policies operate.
Well, it's the same. It's the same sort of comparison that I was thinking about. Thank you. You said injury occurred on exposure.
Yes, Your Honor.
So if it occurred on exposure in year one, it may not manifest itself until year 20, right?
Yes.
What year is important for the policy to come in?
Well, as I understand this court's decision in American Girl, the focus would be bodily injury would occur from the first inhalation of asbestos, and this is because asbestos, when it's inhaled, causes microscopic injuries within the lungs and would continue up until the time that the asbestos-related injury was manifest. Now, what would happen then is, so you could have a continuum of time, and what I'm really talking about in this case is that if there was bodily injury that occurred during our policy period, then we would pay for that bodily injury because that's the critical element, that the bodily injury must be during the policy
period. It would be 68 to 89 here.
That's correct. And I apologize, I'm over my time.
You didn't really get a chance to address the issue that you started out to address to us, and there are two parts. One is whether we all claims, how that applies to a settlement or damages, and the other is how it applies to the obligation to defend, right?
Correct.
Could I ask you a question about the latter part, the obligation to defend?
Yes.
For all the years that there was at least a base policy in effect, do you agree that there was an obligation to defend?
Yes, Your Honor. So if we were in it, and when we're talking about what you're saying, a base policy, you mean a policy that didn't have an asbestos exclusion, for example?
They had two kinds of insurance.
Yeah.
Primary, the bottom primary coverage, and then they had umbrella coverage for a number of years. And what I'm asking you is, with this primary base coverage, whenever that was in effect, do you agree that there was an obligation to defend claims made against Clayco?
Yes, I do agree with that, Your Honor.
So what you really want us to focus on is whether any damages that are paid out, even for those years, should have some adjustments made.
What I'm arguing and is two things simultaneously. One is that I'm arguing that if there was a period of time where bodily injury occurred when Plenco wasn't insured and a period of time when they were insured, that there should be a pro rata allocation. And basically what the court would do, it's essentially a fraction, that Plenco would pay the share for the bodily injury that occurred when it wasn't insured. We would pay for the share for the bodily injury when they were insured.
Don't you have to have a trial on damages then, though, and have someone allocate those damages out? Because if you work in a company for 1 year, certainly your damages, if you keep on being exposed after 10 years, would be more in the 10th year than it would be in the first year. How are you going to prove all of that?
Well, I think that the experience is, first of all, many, many of these cases actually settle, and many of these cases, fairly few cases go to trial. What typically happens in my experience is this, that the insurer and the policyholder in a situation like this will either treat the cases on a case-by-case basis, look at the allegations of the complaint, and look at the proof as it comes in, and they will do their allocation on that basis. Now, sometimes, because what we're really dealing with in the asbestos situation is mass tort, what insurers and policyholders do, and this has been my experience, is they come up with a set percentage that they will pay for the year, and then either they agree that that will be the percentage will apply to all the claims, or they agree that they will do some adjustment at the end of the year based on what the actual experience is. But it's really, it's a matter of spreadsheets and fractions, really, in terms of how this works in, from a day-to-day operation.
Okay, thank you.
Justice Prosser, I don't mean to overstep my welcome.
Justice Prosser will ask you a question, which you will try to answer.
Thank you.
I am simply curious why the parties decided to argue the third issue first,
right,
and whether that signals to the court that we should decide the third issue first when we go into conference.
Your Honor, I don't believe that the fact that we ordered the issues in a particular order was meant to signal anything to the court in terms of the importance of the issues or the order in which the court should decide the issues. I think that the fact that we focused on the third issue first is really a matter that the policy language that you're dealing with, at least this is from a Liberty Mutual standpoint, is a relatively smaller group of language than the language that you're dealing with in the number of occurrences and non-accumulation provision. So, to be honest with you, from my standpoint, it seemed like it was easier to sort of go into the shallow end before I got into the deep end in terms of
policy. Well, now maybe we don't even have to get to three, depending on how we decide occurrence. Is that right?
I think that the two issues are independent in this sense.
What two issues? You've got three issues.
Yes, I'm sorry. The first issue is the issue of whether or not Plenco has to pay for bodily injury that occurred when it wasn't insured. The second issue is, is the issue of number of occurrences, which determines the maximum amount that Liberty Mutual would be obligated to pay in connection with its liability. So whether our liability, if by way of example, the court rejected our position on pro rata allocation, that doesn't mean that the issue on number of occurrences is moot, because you would still end up being in the position of saying, okay, let's assume, and I'm obviously hoping I don't have to make this assumption, that Liberty Mutual is jointly and severally liable. You'd still have to get to the question as to, well, what's the maximum amount that Liberty would have to pay as a result of its limits of liability provision. And then the third issue is really that one of the limits of liability provisions is this non-accumulation provision, which Plenko has taken a position is contrary to a Wisconsin statute. So I do believe that all the issues have to be addressed, and the order was really convenient. So
the real question I had in asking the first question, and I think you may have touched on this, each issue is completely severable. Are you saying that irrespective of how issues 1 and 2 are decided, that will have no impact on the decision on issue 3?
Your Honor, I apologize. I'm going to give you a yes and no answer. Irrespective of how you decide 1 and 2 together, has no impact on number 3. But if the court decides on issue number 1 that there are multiple occurrences, it certainly has an impact on issue number 3, which is how the non-cumulation of limits provision would be applied.
Okay.
But it would not, this court could end up without any contradiction, ruling in favor of Liberty Mutual on issue number 3 and Plenko on issue 1.
I thought Magistrate Goodstein indicated that depending on how you ruled on one of the issues, the others, or at least one of the others, might be moot, but I'll find it.
And Your Honor, I don't mean to overstep my welcome here or overstay my welcome. The issue that he was talking about, and I don't remember where it is in his decision, is Judge Goodstein ended up ruling against Liberty Mutual on a number of occurrences, but in favor of Liberty Mutual on the statute issue.
Right.
And essentially acknowledged that the fact that he had ruled that there were multiple occurrences made our victory on the statute pretty much a Pyrrhic victory.
Okay. I'll check that out. Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Davis, representing Plastic Engineering.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court. My name is Jeff Davis. I represent Plastics Engineering Company, also known as Plenko. With me today is David Strickling from my office, and also with me in court today is the general counsel of Plenko, Jeff Moore. This case was certified by the Seventh Circuit because it involves 3 important issues under Wisconsin insurance law, and they are important to quite a diverse group of Wisconsinites, all of whom have a vested interest in Plinko's success in this case. That group includes Wisconsin businesses, large and small, who are the regular targets of continuous injury type lawsuits such as asbestos and environmental cases. It includes public and quasi-public entities such as utilities. It includes mass tort victims, as alluded to by Chief Justice Abramson. And it also includes the environment, because a ruling in Plinko's favor will make available more funds for cleanups. Now, for my client, Plinko, its very survival is at stake, because this case involves about $60 million in insurance coverage that Liberty Mutual is attempting to eradicate, which I think in some respects answers your question, Chief Justice Abramson, which is that without there being a Plinko, there will be no funds left for any for asbestos victims. Moreover, a ruling in Plinko's favor, again to answer that question, I think on the issue of incentives, which Mr. Sullivan alluded to, an issue or a ruling finding pro rata allocation, which is nowhere found in the policy, will simply provide an incentive to insurers to keep drafting ambiguous language in their insurance policies. Now that said, this is of course an insurance coverage case involving the terms of a standard CGL policy similar to what's been issued to thousands of businesses all over Wisconsin and the country. The underlying liability is the defense and coverage for asbestos claims that were brought against Plinko at various places and times around the country over many years based on different exposure periods. And we're before the court because for some 16 years, Liberty Mutual defended and paid Plinko's claims in full. Then in 2004, Liberty Mutual abruptly changed its position and said, well, now we're only going to pay some pro rata portion of your defense and indemnity costs. Now, these issues have been certified to this court. In this segment of the argument, I'm only going to address issue three, which is where an insured is sued for damages by plaintiffs who claim that their injuries occurred over many years, and an insurer issued policies for some but not all of those years, is the insured, Plainco, entitled to a defense and indemnity for all amounts it has to pay, or must the insurer pay only some pro rata portion of defense costs and damages? I'm talking, of course, about the issue of allocation. What do I mean by allocation? Well, to start with, I think you have to understand the concept of a CGL policy, which provides coverage where there is bodily injury during the policy period. In most cases, that's a pretty straightforward proposition. Now, you have an auto accident, the injury takes place at a discrete point in time, and you know what policy is triggered. But some types of injury are ongoing, including the area of asbestos. And where that's the case, most courts, including this one in American Girl, as Mr. Sullivan indicated, have concluded that any policy that's in effect at the time that the injury applies, or has been called, is triggered. Now, allocation is a term that's arisen to refer to how much coverage is provided under triggered policies in these continuous injury cases. And it's the all sums versus pro rata debate. Our position is all sums or joint and several, meaning that for any triggered policy, the insurer must defend and pay in full.
Also, I found that argument in your brief very interesting. I'm kind of old-fashioned. I always thought of joint and several as a tort concept, but insurance policies are contracts.
It's true. It's a term that's
something you've kind of just developed, or?
It's one of the terms used by the courts in describing what an insurer's obligation is with respect to, and really it does arise out of the contract, as I'm about to indicate, Your Honor. But that is the term that's been used in addition to all sums.
Yeah, I've just never heard of a contract being described as having joint and several liability. I mean, you're either a party to the contract or a third-party beneficiary.
It's the term that I think kind of describes what's the, what the insurer is being has to pay under its policy, but it really does arise out of the policy.
Doesn't it just mean both the insured and the insurer may be liable to the third person?
What's that?
Doesn't it just mean that both the insured and the insurer would be liable to the injured party?
It does not refer to that, Your Honor. It refers to what the insurer's obligations would be, and it basically says that the insurer is entitled to all of the costs that the insured must pay as damages or have to pay in defense costs. And I guess one way of looking at it is when you do have multiple insurers, they all would be liable and then might be able to sort it out amongst themselves by way of contribution actions. And you see that frequently in these types of cases.
Well, why should Liberty be liable if the person came to work in, 1961 to 68? When Liberty didn't insure your client, right?
Right.
So I'm working there from 61 to 68. I'm inhaling like crazy, right?
Right.
And 20 years later, I'm in deep trouble. Okay. So and maybe I quit working at 68.
Well,
why should Liberty pay?
Under the all sums method, no injury has been discovered at that point. The injury is continuing. And by way of under the continuous trigger theory, as asbestos fibers continue to embed themselves in the working
internally to me, right.
Correct. The insurer at that point has purchased coverage that says that the insurer will pay all sums that the insured is responsible for paying for damages during its policy period,
mm-hmm.
And that would be all damages. And I'll show how that works here.
I work 61 to 68 and quit. You think Liberty should pay my damages? I sue your company.
If it's shown that they're
liable?
Correct, Your Honor. Now, that's not, in this particular case, every single lawsuit involves exposure during the policy period. It involves workers who continue to work for plaintiff.
I'm giving you one that didn't.
Okay. It's a trickier question.
Yeah, uh-huh. Then we can get the easier ones. Can I collect from Liberty?
Yes, you can, because your injury is continuing. At the point of manifestation, you can. But
Liberty didn't buy some kind of insurance in 84 and 85, is that right?
Liberty did what?
Plainco did not buy certain insurance in 84 and 85, is that right?
They did have insurance in 84 and 85. There were some periods where...
there was some period in there that they didn't have a Liberty policy.
Exactly, Your Honor. There was another insurer.
Why should Liberty pay for something that happened during that period?
Because it had agreed to pay all sums that the insured is legally obligated to pay as damages for injury during its policy period, and that would mean all of the claimant's damages.
Counsel, can I ask a question? I'm just looking to the definitions in the policy, and I have to reconcile this in my own mind as we go back there and discuss it, but in part I agree with you. The company agrees to pay on behalf of the insured all sums which the insured shall become legally obligated to pay as damages because of bodily injury to which this policy applies caused by an occurrence. And we tend to focus on the definition of occurrence, but the definition of bodily injury seems to be pertinent here too. And bodily injury, as defined, means bodily injury, sickness, or disease sustained by any person which occurs during the policy period. And so doesn't that mean the bodily injury has to occur during the policy period? I'm just trying to sort that out as we go back there.
It certainly has to occur during the policy period in order for the policy to be triggered. There's no dispute about that whatsoever. But once that policy is triggered, then the insurer has to indemnify the insured for all sums.
From what policy?
From that policy. Let me explain it if I could.
Okay, this is policy language. And just one minute. Counsel, can you see this?
Yes.
And do you have copies of that? Do you have copies for the collects?
Microphone.
All right. Okay, is that the problem? All right. Thank you.
Your Honor, this actually is the language of the insuring agreement that I submit Liberty Mutual is seeking to enforce in this case. And it says the company will pay those sums which the insured shall become legally obligated to pay as damages, representing that portion of bodily injury to which this policy applies caused by an occurrence. Bodily injury, of course, is defined as bodily injury which occurs during the policy period. But that's not the policy that Liberty Mutual issued. The policy Liberty Mutual issued, with apologies to Vanna White, says the company will pay all sums which the insured shall become legally obligated to pay as damages, not representing that portion of bodily injury, but because of bodily injury to which this policy applies caused by an occurrence. They agree to pay all sums, which the insured had become legally obligated to pay as damages. And let's focus in here a little bit on the bodily injury part. If Plinko is sued by an asbestos claimant who says that he was exposed, say, in 1973 to a Plinko product, and that was his only exposure, and he was exposed to some other manufacturer's products in 1974, 75, and 76, Plinko, because of that 1 year of exposure, is legally obligated to pay its damages all of that claimant's injury, even though the exposure took place outside of Plinko's, even though the exposure continued after the exposure to the Plinko product. Plinko is jointly and severally liable for damages outside of its exposure period, but at the same time, Liberty Mutual agreed to indemnify Plinko for all of those sums. All this really is the triggering language. The cause of bodily injury to which this policy applies will cause the policy to trigger. And that's what this court held in American Girl. How much the insurer is going to pay in that instance? That's the all sums language. All sums that's insured shall become legally obligated to pay. And if there's exposure in only 1 year during a company, as this definition would indicate, Plinko is nonetheless legally obligated to pay his damages, all of that claimant's
All of the claimant's damages.
Counselor, is Placo legally obligated to pay because it distributed a product that was dangerous without a warning?
That's the allegations in the lawsuits, Your Honor.
And
that is why Placo would be legally obligated to pay those damages. There's a nice quote from a Third Circuit case. It's the ACNS case, which says that it is uncontested that under principles of tort law, ACNS may be held fully liable for personal injury plaintiff's damages caused in part by ACNS asbestos during a particular period, even though plaintiff's damages may also have been caused in part at other times. It follows that if a plaintiff's damages are caused in part during an insured period, it is irrelevant to ACNS legal obligation and therefore to the insurer's liability that they were also caused in part during another period. Again, they could have put some kind of pro rata clause in their policy, but they didn't do it. Now, I want to turn quickly to another part of the policy that I think is even, if anything, more clear at this point. And that'd be the defense clause, with respect to the duty to defend. This is the language that I would submit Liberty Mutual is seeking to enforce in this case. It says the company shall have the right and duty to defend that portion of any suit against the insured seeking damages on account of such bodily injury. Again, bodily injury being defined as that which occurs during the policy period. That's what Liberty Mutual wants to do in this case. Pay Placo a portion of its defense costs based on some pro rata formula. That's not what the policy reads. It says the company shall have the right and duty to defend any suit against the insured seeking damages on account of such bodily injury. And that means the whole suit. Not part of the suit, not a portion of the suit in its entirety. And that position is black letter law in this state. From case after case, the Doyle v. Engelke case, Fireman's Fund v. Bradley, and any number of others from both this court and the Court of Appeals and the federal courts interpreting Wisconsin law, that the duty to defend, if triggered, requires the insurer to defend the suit in its entirety. There's no way that an insurer can prorate defense costs. There's really not even an argument here, Your Honor. Again, Wisconsin courts to date have uniformly ruled in favor of all sums or joint and several in these types of cases. You've got trial courts, Judge Kitty Brennan from Milwaukee County, Judge Mike Dooley, Judge Wasileski, and most recently, Judge Zeidmelder from Brown County, have all predicted that this court would adopt an all-sums method with respect to both defense and indemnity. Now, while the case law around the country goes both ways on this issue, I think there's a reason why the lower courts, and every Wisconsin Circuit Court, as well as Judge Goodstein from the federal courts, has adopted all-sums. First, given this court's position with respect to the duty to defend and how strong it's been and how well established it is in this court, that a duty to defend requires an insurer to defend the entire suit, a pro rata allocation method would be completely contrary to that. And if applied to defense costs, I think it would require this court to overrule at least three of its decisions, as well as those from the courts of appeals in the federal courts that have interpreted Wisconsin law.
You have to have the same rule as to defend as well as pay. Do you have to defend the whole thing but only pay pro rata?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case in the country that has divided pro rata and all sums between defense costs and indemnity damages. If there are any, there are very few. Almost all of the pro rata cases, frankly, haven't addressed duty to defend very much. And they typically do it with respect. They simply do it on respect to the indemnity clause.
May I ask? There are at least one other insurance company, a couple other insurance companies in this whole lengthy period.
There is one other insurance company, and that actually is the subject of litigation in another case involving both Liberty Mutual. It's a contribution action between that other insurance company and Liberty Mutual and Placo. It involves some other issues, but that is subject.
So you're saying that all sums does not vitiate in any way the contribution
It would not. This court hasn't really ruled on that, but for the most part, courts around the country have found that there are ethical principles that come into play at between insurance companies that would allow them to apportion the damages or the insurance proceeds among themselves. As between the insured and the insurers, it's a matter of contract. But as between insurance companies, there are some ethical principles that come into play and would allow for contribution actions as far as I'm concerned.
At the beginning of your comments, you made some reference to what I understood to be some of the amicus filed here, talking about the Small Business Association, and also made reference to environmental cases. Does the analysis that we would apply in interpreting the CGL policy with regard to issue 3, and indeed all issues 1 and 2, would that analysis be the same whether it is a products liability lawsuit or an environmental cleanup lawsuit?
I think it would, Your Honor. I think in all those cases what we're really talking about here are the so-called continuous injury cases, where injury takes place over multiple policy periods. And there are any number of types of cases where that would apply. One would be environmental, another would be asbestos, other types of mass tort cases where that would...
Counselor, in some cleanup cases, and there's an environmental spill, and I do it on my property today, so it's now in the ground, I sell you my property the next day, and you own it for 5 years, and then somebody's injured by this seeping stuff, aren't we both on the hook?
You are, Your Honor.
Well, is that the same as what's going on here with Placo's introduction of this asbestos-containing product without a warning?
Well, I mean, under environmental laws, anyone who is potentially responsible under CERCLA would be jointly and severally liable for
this. Right, so it's a different construct than when we have here, when you have someone who introduced, it wasn't, at least in my mind, it's conceptually different. You have the introduction of asbestos into the marketplace, and it then results in exposure to work people who are making products out of this asbestos-containing compound. But, never mind.
I think actually there are some real similarities, because in almost all the asbestos cases, a claimant will sue multiple.
Oh, sure. And they sue the employer, but they're stuck with workers' comp and
right.
Things
and that was my point earlier, is that, Planko would be stuck with all of the damages, even if part of the exposure took place outside of its exposure period, outside of the policy period. I see my time's up. Could I have maybe 30 seconds or a minute?
Just summarize it quickly, please.
In the last point I guess I want to make, Your Honors, is that at a bare minimum, there's ambiguity with respect to this language on these points. And I'll just say, if there was no ambiguity, then why did Liberty Mutual pay 100% of all of Planko's defense and indemnity costs for 16 years before claiming some right of partial payment? Without batting an eye, Liberty Mutual paid all of these costs. Moreover, it would have been very easy for Liberty Mutual to write a policy that said it was required to indemnify for only some portion of defense costs and sums that Planko was legally obligated to pay. It didn't do that. And under the terms of its policies, Planko is therefore entitled to 100% of both defense and indemnity costs under any policy that's triggered. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sullivan.
Your Honor, I'd like to respond to a couple of points that were raised during the course of the Planko's argument. One of the first is a question was asked as to whether or not, if this court ruled against Liberty Mutual on the issue of allocation of the duty to defend, did that mean that we had to lose on the allocation of the duty to pay judgments or settlements? And the answer is no, because there are separate obligations. An obligation to defend is separate from the obligation to indemnify. There are, in fact, courts that have said we're going to require the insurer to pay all of the defense costs, but not pay all of the indemnity. And the courts particularly are the Supreme Court of Minnesota in the Domtar and the NSP cases. So a ruling on duty to defend does not preclude a ruling in our favor in connection with the duty to indemnify.
You think they can be split?
I'm sorry, I didn't...
You think that the two issues can be decided differently?
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. Justice Bradley, you asked a question as to whether or not the ruling in here would be limited just to products liability claims, or whether it would apply to different types of claims. And my answer is certainly with respect to the issue that we're talking about on in issues 1 and 2, which I will get to, I think that what we're talking about is something that is specific as to products liability claims, and I intend to address that later, and I can address it right now, but it may make more sense if I address it in the context of that argument. One issue that isn't entirely clear to me in terms of how this ruling on allocation might apply in the context of non-products liability cases is the issue of, you know, sometimes in the environmental context, liability isn't based on tort concepts. It's based on environmental statutes. And so we're really not in a position that we can talk about that in connection with this particular issue that's before the court.
With regard to the third issue, yes, several of the amicus, that's exactly what they're talking about. They write only on the third issue, the all sums issue, and bring in the concerns with regard to environmental litigation.
I'm trying to make sure that I'm being clear that certainly if this court ruled that a policyholder is obligated to pay for bodily injury that occurred when it wasn't insured, that would have an impact on environmental cases in which an insured caused pollution or property damage during a period that it wasn't insured. What is different, and what I can't really answer in this context, is that in the tort context, you have a clear liability that is based on bodily injury that is caused by the insured. In the environmental context, you sometimes have environmental statutes that have an interplay there, and I don't think we're in a position to answer that specific question, but clearly, yes, this court's ruling will have an impact on coverage for pollution-type claims.
How about this question? The very last comment of your opposing counsel was, at a bare minimum, the language of the policy is ambiguous. I mean, without ambiguity, why would Liberty Mutual have been paying the full boat for the last 16 years? Can you respond to that?
Yes, I can, Your Honor, but this argument that's being made that Liberty Mutual suddenly changed its position is an argument that isn't supported in the record, and my response would essentially come from something that's outside of the record.
Let me ask you this. Is it in the record whether or not up until 2004 you paid all sums? Is that in the record?
The record is that we have paid all of the defense costs and we paid all the judgments and settlements. But, Your Honor, we're also in a position that we're looking at a scenario where first of all, that was done under a reservation of rights. And secondly, that was done at a time when, prior to 2003, Liberty Mutual had settled a total of 4 claims on behalf of Plenco.
Mm-hmm. And so, when did you put in the reservation of rights? At the get-go or along the way?
There were reservation of rights letters that were issued throughout the period of time, and then those reservation of rights changed over time as well for this reason. The reservations of rights always address the question of we don't owe coverage for bodily injury that doesn't take place during the policy. The reservation of rights initially, because there seemed to be no prospect that these claims were going to reach policy limits, didn't address the limits of liability provisions. Those limits of liability provisions became relevant essentially in 2003, 2004, when Plenco's liability essentially exploded. It became more of a target. So, yes, we addressed the issue of we don't owe coverage for bodily injury that takes place outside the policy period. The issue really is, under this court's analysis in terms of the estoppel rules, Liberty Mutual didn't take the chance and not defend the insured. We defended the insured. We paid sums. The sums that we were paying were relatively minimal.
And Mr. Sullivan, in a case that I was involved in, I was sitting out there, and opposing counsel used a chart very effectively.
Yes.
And I lost. Do you have a rebuttal on this?
I do, Your Honor. And the rebuttal that I have, if I...
Going to need that or...
Floating microphone.
Thank you. The rebuttal that I have is, if we look at the first sign, the reality is that what Plenko argues here is that the language should stop at damages. That we should pay all sums which the insured becomes legally obligated to pay as damages. Where the language is that says that we don't pay for bodily injury that takes place outside the policy period is in this part of the policy, because what we said is we'll pay the damages because of bodily injury to which this policy applies. And the bodily injury to which this policy applies, as Justice Ziegler looked at, was bodily injury is defined as bodily injury that takes place during the policy. So what we agreed to do was that we would pay for all liability based on bodily injury that takes place during the policy period. Now, an issue that was raised was the question of joint and several liability. Liberty Mutual pays for Plenko's joint and several liability. But what we are saying is Plenko's liability isn't based on bodily injury that occurred in a single year that Plenko chooses. Bodily injury occurred every year that people were exposed to asbestos. Some of those years were years where Plenko made a business judgment not to buy insurance. Our position is that the years in which they made that business judgment not to buy insurance, they should be liable for the injury that occurred during that period. That's what the policy says. And that's why we're asking the court to enforce the pro rata allocation approach.
Counsel, do you think a reasonable insured would read that language and think because he shows up with asbestos in 1980, that Plenko would think that, well, we're not covered because he may have gotten an asbestos injury back in 1955?
I'm hoping that a reasonable insured would read the policy. And there are two responses that I would give to that. Three reasons that I would respond to that. First, the policy says we will pay for bodily injury that occurs during the policy period. Second, that policy period is stated on the declarations page of our policy, and it's stated to the minute. It starts at 12:01 a.m. on January 1st and goes to 12:01 a.m. Well, I think that that indicates that the policy period is an important consideration.
I guess I didn't say my question very well.
I apologize.
No, it's not your problem. It's mine with doing a better question. I was trying to look at it from Plenko's position, who buys a policy to cover things that they may do so that they're insured, okay? And they do something way back here in 1950. Well, they bought this policy in 1970, and lo and behold, within the four squares, within the timeline set forth on the deck page, a former employee comes in and is sicker than heck and makes a claim. Okay, when Plenko bought this policy, do you think that Plenko, as a reasonable insured, could have believed that it would not cover this man's injury, which is now showing up, because he was working for Plenko way back in 1950?
I think that they should read it that way.
Why?
For this reason. If bodily injury was occurring in the 1960s when they didn't
but
have...
Did they know it? You see, I mean, I don't... Most of these asbestos cases arose because people didn't know how dangerous this stuff was. So, you know, the reasonable insured that buys the policy and sees the injury down the road, how is he to have reasonably interpreted that to say, well, you got that injury back in 1950, so probably this policy may cover some of it, but it doesn't cover all of it? How would they know that?
And the answer is, Planko may not have known that bodily injury was taking place, but certainly when Planko comes into the marketplace and decides, we're only going to buy insurance for one of our products, and we're selling lots of other products, and products liability law is exploding, then I think it's certainly fair to say that they assumed the risk that bodily injury might take place during the period of time when they weren't buying the insurance. They weren't paying premium for it. Our premiums were based on sales.
Is there a fact question that underlies that determination of what Planko should reasonably have known?
I'm not sure that there's a fact question, because I'm not sure that the fact that they may not have known that asbestos claims were coming down the pike is determinative of whether or not there's coverage. For this reason, they certainly knew they didn't have products liability coverage for this product during a period of time. So it could have been, by way of example, you could have had a claim where they did come in early on, and they wouldn't have had that coverage.
But, I mean, in 1950, did the manufacturers like Planko, who made products that, various products that contained asbestos, know asbestos was very dangerous to the workers who worked with it?
Well, there's certainly nothing about that in the record in this case, but there is certainly documentation that's out there that many, many asbestos manufacturers were aware of the dangers of asbestos very early on. And that's one of the basis, for example, of many of the claims against Johns Manville.
But one of your conclusions really is that the company should have known that bodily injury could have occurred back in 1950 when they bought this policy, so they shouldn't have been expecting 100% coverage for this injury, which manifests itself in 1980, right?
One of my... Yes, I'm making two arguments.
Okay.
One is the argument of the simple fact is they didn't buy the insurance. And if they didn't buy the insurance, then if bodily injury occurred when they didn't buy the insurance, then there's no coverage for it, and they should be liable, not an insurance company. So whether or not they were an innocent insured or a knowledgeable insured, you know, if tomorrow I don't buy insurance for my auto because I think I'm the world's greatest driver.
And that's a little different, though. I mean, I think that there's a certain amount of scientific evidence that underlies these claims that wasn't always apparent to everyone.
But what really did happen in this situation, and I think that is relevant, is, number one, they didn't buy the insurance, but the second thing is they actually bought insurance for one of their products. So clearly they knew that there was a danger of products liability. They may not have fully appreciated the danger of products liability with respect to these molding compounds, but they took that risk. They said, we'll cover this product, but none of our other products.
They covered molded plastic products. So like if they made a product that was, I don't know what the heck you would consider, but some kind of a device that was molded plastic that was to carry tools in, and it broke and fell on someone and they got hurt, well, they're buying insurance for that. But this other compound was something they made, but other people used it to make products, right?
Other people used it to make products, and in the case of the molded products, yes, Planko made those products, but they were still making an economic decision. Do we want to pay premium? Because the premium was based on sales. Do we want to pay premium based on our sales of molded products, molding compounds, I apologize. And the answer that they made, for whatever reason, was no.
Okay.
And what I'm asking this court to do is to say they should be held to that business decision that they made.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you.
And I recognize, I apologize, I'm...
Well, it was me. I was just confused a little bit. We have a ways to go. We have now finished certified question number three. We are now going to move to certified questions one and two. I'm stalling to give you enough time to get some water because you're up first again.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Sullivan.
These first two questions address what constitutes an insurance contract, or an occurrence, I apologize, in an insurance contract when exposure injuries are sustained by numerous individuals at various geographic locations over many years. And the second is whether the Wisconsin statute, section 631.431, applies to successive insurance policies. I'm going to start with the number of occurrences issue. And the answer to the question in terms of what is an occurrence and what constitutes an occurrence is answered by the policy language. And the policy language looks at the question of what conduct of the insured caused it to be legally liable. If we look back at the chart, the chart uses the phrase at the end, caused by an occurrence. That is, the caused by an occurrence language looks at the question of what is it, what event did the insured do that resulted in its bodily injury for which it is liable. With respect to that issue, Your Honor, we have an additional policy provision that is directly relevant, and that is the limits of liability provision in the policy. And it makes sense to start with this provision because this provision states that it is the provision that applies for the purpose of determining the limits of the company's liability. And really, this occurrence issue is relevant for purposes of determining the company's liability. Now, there are only a couple of paragraphs in the limits of liability provision, but there are four different elements that I think are important and relevant in understanding the issue. First, the limits of liability provision states that the limit applies regardless of the number of persons who sustain bodily injury. Immediately after that language appears, there is a limit of liability that is stated as the limit for each occurrence, and that limit is the limit of the company's liability for all bodily injury, in the language it uses, sustained by one or more persons. So these two provisions in the limits of liability section of the policy make it clear that the focus in determining the number of occurrences is not the number of people that are injured, because the policy says that the limits of liability apply regardless of the number of people who sustain injuries, regardless of the number of people who file claims or suits. The third provision that is relevant within this limits of liability section of the policy is the non-cumulation of limits provision. And that provision says, if the same occurrence gives rise to personal injury or bodily injury, which occurs partly before and partly within any annual period of the policy. So basically what that part of the policy says is you can have an occurrence which causes bodily injury that takes place over more than 1 year, that can take place over several years. So that part of the policy makes it clear that the test for determining number of occurrences isn't whether the injuries were close in time, makes it clear that the test isn't whether that the occurrence is the immediate cause of injury, because this language gives a separation which recognizes that a single occurrence can result in bodily injuries to multiple people that take place over many years. And the last part of the limits of liability provision is the provision that sets out the test within the policy for determining the number of occurrences. And that is, it says that all bodily injury arising out of continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general conditions shall be considered as arising out of one occurrence. So the test under the policy is whether the general circumstances out of which the injuries arose are substantially similar. With that in mind, I then go and look at the stipulated facts in this case, including the complaint that was filed against Plinko that we used as an exemplar complaint. It's been stipulated that all of the asbestos claims to date have been claims arising out of the sales of Plinko's molding compounds. All of the claims have been brought by individuals who worked in plastics molding facilities to which Plinko sold those molding compounds. If we look at the complaint, the complaints don't allege anything about the specifics of the Plinko products. The allegation against Plinko is that Plinko is liable because it included asbestos in its products and failed to provide any adequate warning to those who used the products. So basically, what we have is a limits of liability provision that looks at whether or not we have continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general conditions. And here, we have asbestos claimants who are alleging that because of the inherently dangerous nature of the asbestos that's in the molding compounds, they were injured. And I apologize, Justice.
My problem with this, which is similar to what we had in another case, which was a certified question, is we're not asked to rule on the law as applied to the facts pleaded or stipulated, right? We're asked a raw, abstract legal question, right?
Yes,
what's the abstract legal question we're asked that we have to answer as to occurrence? What is that?
I think that the abstract legal question that you're being asked is to formulate a test for what would be the number of occurrences in a situation involving bodily injury claims that arise out of the manufacture and sale of an inherently dangerous product, because that's what we really have here. And this,
what does the question say?
The question says what constitutes an occurrence in an insurance contract when exposure injuries are sustained by numerous individuals at various geographic locations.
Over many years. It says over many years. No?
Yes, I apologize. I didn't mean to short-circuit the question.
So the answer to that question is?
The answer to that question is that the occurrence is the continued manufacture and sale of the defective product with a failure, or with a accompanied by a failure to warn.
So the, in shorthand, what we have here is what constitutes an occurrence. Is it the continued manufacture and sale, or is it your opposing counsel that says it's the continued exposure? Am I right? Is that what this debate on issue one is?
That is what the debate on issue one is, although I would argue that even if this court found that it was the claimant's exposures, that given the language of the policy, which talks about all bodily injury arising out of continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general conditions, and given the allegations of the complaints against Plinko, in which all the claims against Plinko are based on the fact that it included asbestos in its products, the complaints against Plinko do not allege that exposure at one location or another location or one time or another time was any dangerous. The focus of the complaints, any more dangerous, the focus of the complaints, the focus of the allegations is if you include asbestos in your product, it's inherently dangerous, and the people who use it will be harmed.
You've briefed this case as though we are to write the opinion in this case solving the specific fact situation, the specific complaints in this case. And it seems to me, with regard to question one, and this was touched upon by the chief's question, there are different approaches that we can take. We can take a much more general approach, and we can just expound upon, the cause theory, and then leave it to the Seventh Circuit to apply the answer to their inquiry. Are you asking that this court apply the answer to the inquiry?
Your Honor, I'm not presuming to tell the court what it should do, but I read what the Seventh Circuit was asking the court for was guidance as to what test should be applied in determining this issue in connection with the occurrences.
And so we have to decide the first issue. I mean, there's a number of ways we can decide it, a number of approaches. But at face value, the answer to their first question is, at least as briefed by the parties, is the definition of going to be of an occurrence in this kind of a context, multiple parties, multiple times, multiple distances, is the occurrence the manufacture and sale, or is it the exposure, right?
That is correct, yes, Your Honor.
What difference does that make to me as the injured party?
The difference in terms of in this situation is realistically a question of whether it's Liberty Mutual that's going to be paying or an excess carrier above Liberty Mutual that's going to be paying. I mean, typically these disputes end up being disputes between primary and excess carriers, because really if the court finds in Liberty Mutual's favor and ends up ruling that Liberty Mutual's coverage is limited because of these provisions, because of these limits of liability provisions, then the end result is Liberty would, once it paid its limits of liability or its limit, it would have no further obligation to pay, and therefore the obligation would be either an excess carrier, or if Plenco did not have coverage, it would be Plenco's obligation.
It just seems like we're missing something here. I'm Sam Smith. What do I want? And I'm an injured party. What do I want the answer to this question to be? Now, I want it to be based on the law, okay, of course. But what would I be advocating, given these two developed positions? What am I advocating?
Your Honor, I think it depends on the case, and it depends on the factual circumstances. In this particular case, we don't have this issue of number of occurrences isn't one in which finding a single occurrence means that it's always good for the insurer. Sometimes it's good for the policyholder.
About the injured parties, that's what I talk about, Sam Smith. I'm not talking about the policyholder, I'm talking about the injured party.
Well, I have to presume that any injured party always wants coverage to be maximized, because I think any injured party always wants to be in a situation where there's as much coverage as available. But I think that the problem that we run into is that in this case, our question is, well, what are our obligations under this contract?
Yeah, but the insured wants as much coverage as possible. So here, the insured and the injured party are in the same position. They want as much coverage from the insurance company as they can get. When I buy insurance policy, I want it to cover everything.
Well, and I think that that's, unfortunately, that that's going to be true in any situation. Every time an insurer comes in with a coverage dispute, the policyholder is going to want to maximize the coverage. I think that the question, though, is, this court in numerous cases has said, the fact that there are tort plaintiffs who may want to maximize coverage, or that the insured may want to maximize coverage, that can't be the driving force in the court's interpretation, because the policy interpretation is based on what does the contract say.
Counselor, you
sold insurance to Placo to cover Placo's conduct for which they could be found liable, correct?
Correct.
Did Placo expose anyone to asbestos, or did they just sell it to third parties who exposed some of these underlying plaintiffs to asbestos?
There's no claim that I'm aware of that involves, for example, somebody coming into a Placo facility and being exposed there. So the claims are products liability claims. Placo sold an asbestos-containing product to which claimants were exposed.
Okay, and this is a CGL policy, so I don't know if it's the workers' comp policy for Placo 2 or not. Do you know, or is that part of the record?
It talks about
their employees in the policy.
This would not be a workers' comp policy, and the employees that were being referred to are not employees of Placo. Placo would sell its molding compound to a facility that used those molding compounds to make plastic products.
Yes, I understand that.
Employees who worked in those facilities, so employees of the customer, would be exposed to the asbestos in the molding compounds. If the Liberty Mutual policies have employee exclusions, these general liability policies, mm-hmm. So if we were dealing with the question of a Placo employee, we would be dealing with a workers' compensation
right.
policy.
I understand that. I just didn't know if this policy might apply to both workers' comp and third-party liability outside of Placo's employees, but you're telling me it just applies to folks that were employees of someone else, not of Placo.
Exactly. It's just third-party liability.
Thank you.
How many occurrences were there in this case?
Our claim is that there's one occurrence.
And it lasted 30-some years?
Yes, Your Honor. Because the argument that we're making is that they sold an asbestos-containing product, and they sold that product for 33 years, and the key is that for purposes of determining the limits of liability, that all the bodily injury arising out of substantially the same general conditions are result from one occurrence. So in this case, all the bodily injury arose out of substantially the same general conditions. That is, as alleged in the exemplar complaint, the inclusion of this inherently dangerous product in these molding compounds and the failure to warn of the danger associated with
and quickly applying the logic of your position, what would be the total indemnification coverage?
The total indemnification coverage under Liberty Mutual's position would be $23.5 million. And the reason I'm just to explain, I'm excluding the period of time prior to 1968 when we didn't cover them at all for products hazard, and I'm excluding the period when we had asbestos exclusions. But under Liberty Mutual's analysis, the end result would be that our total indemnification would be $23.5 million.
What is that per policy year?
The way the policies work is this, that at the primary level, I have to consult my notes because I get lost on the policy chart at times as well. The primary policies from February of 68 until January of 86 all had $500,000 limits.
How does that fit into your non-cumulative argument?
Only a few of the primary policies that were at the primary level had non-cumulation provisions.
And which few? At the beginning, it's in 1968 or in 1986?
Actually, in the middle. 1177 to 1184. Those policies had non-cumulation of limits provisions.
So between 77 and 84, the total of those policies on for
the primary coverage would pay for those 7 years, I guess, $500,000. Is that correct?
That's correct,
Your Honor. Under your argument? Okay.
Under the umbrella policies, all of the umbrella policies that were issued by Liberty Mutual included the non-QM from the very beginning in May of 1970 through the time when the asbestos exclusion.
So all of the umbrella policies had non-cumulative provision?
All of the umbrella policies issued by Liberty Mutual, yes. I actually don't know what the policies issued in those 2 intervening years where U.S. Fire was the insurer.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I know what their policy provisions were off the top of
my head. So other than the 2 intervening years, the umbrella was for what period of time, could you tell me?
Ran from May 8th of 1970 until January 1st of 1984, and then we were back on the risk again as of January of 1986 until January of 1988.
January 1988. And what was the amount of the umbrella in January of 1988?
$10 million.
And then is it a total of $10 million that you're paying on your umbrella policy?
No, Your Honor, because of the break in the coverage, the 2 years where U.S. Fire provided coverage, the way the policies are written and the non-cumulation of limits provision is written, it refers to policies of which a particular policy is a replacement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Liberty Mutual's position that for the period from May of 1970 until January of 84, Plainco would be entitled to the highest limit at that point in time, and that highest limit happened to be from 72 until 82, and it was $5 million.
So for the period, the 14 years from 1970 to 84, one policy year that's relevant had a $5 million umbrella limit, and that's what then would be paid for all of those years. That one policy year, $5 million. Is that
correct? That's
correct.
And that's as a result of the operation of the non-cumulation of limits provision. Now, Your Honor, I again recognize that I have run out of time.
One question. Would your answer to the first question be different if we eliminated the words, what constitutes an occurrence and insurance contract when exposure injuries are sustained by, and I'm eliminating numerous individuals, and eliminating varying geographical locations. Do those two make any difference?
I think that they don't for this reason, that because the policy language as written says that the limits of liability apply regardless of the number of people
right.
that are injured,
mm-hmm.
my answer would be if you had fewer people injured, you would still, or more people injured, you'd still end up with the same result. The other aspect of your question was the aspect of
varying locations.
Various locations. And the answer is the fact that there are multiple locations doesn't have an impact. And the reason that I say that is there are policies that are issued by companies. And by way of example, the London market has issued some policies that were at issue in the Kaiser case, which is one of the cases that was cited by Plenko. And those policies have provisions that say all bodily injury arising out of exposure at a particular location or at one location will be deemed as single occurrences.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
if you had that policy provision, you'd have to look at
yeah.
the location.
Right.
But we do not have that language. That is not the contract that Plainco bought.
Chief, if I may, with regard to your primary, so your primary for all of these years is your exposure is $500,000.
No, Your Honor.
From 77.
The exposure from 77 through 84 is 500,000.
It's 500,000. Okay.
For all the other years, you accumulate the limits because we don't have non-cumulation provisions in those policies.
Got it. So for that non-cumulation for 77 to 84, now that's regardless of the number of claimants you have. They would have that five, let's say, how many claimants are there? Do you have any idea? Is it in the record?
No, I don't believe that it is in the record.
It's obviously numerous because that's part of the certified question, that is numerous individuals. So the numerous individuals would be sharing, divvying up the $500,000. Is that right?
That's correct. And when we look at the policy language is specific. It says that the limit of liability applies regardless of the number of people who are injured, regardless of the number of claims or suits that are brought. So I'm saying that because that's what the limits of liability provision says straight out. And the limits of liability provision also says, there's other language in the same paragraph that says that the occurrence limit is the maximum that would be paid by Liberty Mutual for bodily injuries sustained by one or more persons. So the language is explicit that that's how it's supposed to work.
And Mr. Sullivan, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Davis?
Thank you, Your Honor. And this second sequence of the argument involves certified issues 1 and 2. Certified issue 1 being whether this is involving one occurrence or more than one occurrence. And it's important, of course, because the parties have an anti-stacking provision labeled a single limit or non-accumulation clause in the Liberty Mutual policies, which states that for any given occurrence, the most coverage the plaintiff will have essentially will be the limits of a single policy. And so the court has to decide the number of occurrences in this case. And to do that, the court, I think, has to decide what is the occurrence. Liberty Mutual contends that it's the decision to manufacture products containing asbestos. So if there's one occurrence, Plinko contends that it's each individual claimant's exposure to asbestos. Now, I want to make clear that if the claimant's injury is considered a separate occurrence, if that term is used in the policy, the anti-stacking clause will never come into play for most, if not all, of the injuries at issue here, because those injuries never reach the limits of any given policies in terms of settlements or judgments in almost all cases, in fact, in all the cases to date. So at that point, the court, that's why Judge Goodstein, to answer your earlier question, Chief Justice, is ruled that the statutory issue and is essentially a Pyrrhic victory, as Mr. Sullivan had alluded to.
Well, is it your position that if Justice Bradley and I worked in another plant that used plastics products, that we have two occurrences? Is that it? We're both suffering from injury to our lungs?
Yes, Your Honor, because it's our position that each separate claimant's continued and repeated exposure to asbestos should constitute a separate occurrence, as that term is defined in the policy and as the occurrence has been construed by this court.
Assume that we worked there for 10 years, including these years. And let's just assume the policy's always had a maximum of $500,000. How much can I collect?
You could collect up to, you could collect, any individual claimant would be able to collect up to that single limit.
Up to $500,000. So I've been there 10 years, I don't get 10 times $500,000.
No, you would not. Not if the non-accumulation provision is given effect. Now, there's some tricky aspects of this because, as Mr. Sullivan alluded to, there were a couple of periods where there was no coverage and it continued again. And so you end up piling up at least two limits on the primary level as well as some limits at the umbrella level. So you would get more than $500,000. But under your somewhat simple hypothetical, where there's a non-cum clause and a limit of $500,000, that's the way that clause would operate. Now, once again, Your Honors, the starting point with this issue, of course, is the language of the policies, and specifically in this case, the definition of occurrence. And once again, I would submit that Liberty Mutual is ignoring the language of its policies. We have another chart. This issue as well. In connection with occurrence, This, I would submit, is the language of the policy that Liberty Mutual would like to see have enforced in this case. And it defines occurrence as an act or decision which results in bodily injury or property damage as determined from the standpoint of the insured. This is essentially the act or decision in this case being, of course, Liberty or Plinko's decision to manufacture products incorporating asbestos. And Liberty Mutual would go on to say that you determine what is the act or decision from the standpoint of the insured. That's in their briefs over and over. But once again, that's not the policy that Liberty Mutual issued in this case. The policy that Liberty Mutual issued says occurrence is not an act or decision, but it's an accident. And it's an accident that it would include continuous or repeated exposure to conditions. Now, I don't think you can fairly say that Plinko's decision to manufacture products incorporating asbestos was an accident. In fact, this court has defined accident on any number of occasions, most recently in the Stewart case, which came out just a couple of months ago, where an accident was defined as an event or condition occurring by chance or arising from unknown or remote causes.
Counselor, what about if the accident is the failure to warn? That's what they allege in the complaint. They don't say they accidentally made asbestos products. They said they failed to warn that they were unreasonably dangerous. Why isn't that an accident?
Well, once again, I don't think that that's an event or a condition occurring by chance or arising from an unknown or remote cause.
I mean, it's unknown. If they didn't know that the asbestos was dangerous, why isn't the failure to warn fall within that definition?
Well, again, Your Honor, I would submit that in that particular situation, that the failure to warn was not the type of not something that we would normally or ordinarily insured would consider an accident. And again, I think that in some ways goes. The Stewart case really is on point with that.
Well, Stewart talked about a volitional act, which was making a misrepresentation, and the fact that what was said was intended to be said is quite different than whether Plinko intended to distribute a product that was unreasonably dangerous without a warning.
Well, we're certainly not contending that Plinko intended to distribute a product, you know, without a dangerous product or anything else. But it did intend to distribute the product, and it did intend to incorporate asbestos. And in fact, you know, there are cases where I think you could even make that point, you know, the point with respect to what is an accident, a little more forcefully than you would in this case. For example, there's a case out of Illinois, which is cited in our briefs, it's the Mason case, where you've got tainted food, where clearly, you know, that would be more likely to be an accident. Some contaminant actually gets in the food product accidentally. And even in that case, the Illinois Supreme Court had said that the accident was not that the act of the food or the paint getting in the food. It was actually the each individual distribution of the food.
Counselor, if I were to look at it as distributing a product without a warning, why do you think that makes it? You seem to think that makes it fall into exposure to conditions. Why is that an exposure to conditions?
A failure to warn?
Yeah, not warning. Why does that? I mean, you seem to be arguing that if I buy this argument that it's a distribution without warning of an unreasonably dangerous product, then I'm perforce am hopping right into saying, well, that was the exposure to condition. Why does repeated sales throughout the United States have to be one occurrence or?
I don't. Well, first of all, there's no injury at that point. The exposure to conditions, I mean, I think I agree with you, Your Honor. You know, I think that the act of manufacturing and selling a product is not an exposure to conditions. In fact, the exposure to conditions fits precisely within Plinko's definition of occurrence, which is that the occurrence takes place when each individual claimant is exposed to injurious conditions and suffers injury.
But it only has to be in Wisconsin a cause. You know, we could have six causes. We could have the exposure being a cause, you could have the distribution being a cause, right?
That's true, Your Honor.
All right. So an occurrence just needs to have a cause. You guys seem to agree that that's the law. Is that
correct? Well, I agree that Wisconsin has adopted the cause test. And in fact, I think what we're arguing in this case is that the cause in this case was the injurious exposure as opposed to the injury. Now, what's important about the cause test in Wisconsin is that Wisconsin has found that timing with respect to cause is very important. And for that, you can go back to the Olson test, which adopted the cause test, where this court said that though a single uninterrupted cause, which results in a number of injuries or separate instances of property damage, is yet one accident or occurrence. If, however, that cause is interrupted or replaced by another cause, the chain of causation is broken and more than one accident or occurrence has taken place. And you've got the old adage about a butterfly's wings flapping in Brazil causing a tornado in Texas. You can't just look at any cause. It's got to be the immediately injury-producing cause.
We don't have proximate cause in Wisconsin. We have a substantial factor of an injury.
I agree, Your Honor, but for insurance purposes, in terms of what is determining an occurrence, this court has held that it is the immediate injury-producing cause that a reasonable insurer the most likely view as what is the accident causing, you know, causing injury. And I also want to go on to say that this policy doesn't say that you determine that from the standpoint of the insured, as Liberty Mutual has argued in its briefs. The situation has to be bodily injury that's neither expected nor intended from the standpoint of the insured. That's simply an intentional acts exclusion. And so, Planko here certainly did not expect or intend bodily injury with respect to injurious exposure. It wasn't present when the injurious exposure took place. Now, once again, Your Honors, I think that is fully consistent with Wisconsin law. In fact, in the Olson case, this court cited to another case, a Fifth Circuit case, Liberty Mutual versus Walls, involving a traffic accident. And in that case, the insured had hit one automobile, causing, having an impact, and then continued and hit a second automobile 5 seconds later. And the court in that case said that there were two occurrences. And this court cited that decision with approval. I guess the point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is that occurrence has been defined with respect to in terms of what is the cause, as what is the most immediately producing injury, and that is fully consistent, I think, with our theory here, which is the exposure to the asbestos that causes should be considered the occurrence in this case. Other provisions of the policy.
So your interpretation has several occurrences occurring.
Yes.
And your opposing counsel has one occurrence.
Yes,
is that correct?
It's our position that we have multiple claimants who suffer exposure at different times, different locations, under different circumstances, and suffer injury at different points in time. That would involve multiple occurrences.
Are there also multiple products involved?
Well, certainly there are multiple products. All the products would contain asbestos, of course. But each individual claimant would be exposed to a separate product.
I don't mean multiple individual products. I mean multiple kinds of products.
Types
of products. Thank you. That was my something I read led me to conclude that we're talking about also different types of products containing asbestos.
The record is not developed on that point, but in fact there are multiple types of products, and the record does reflect that at least in this case, there are at least two different forms in which asbestos was sold and distributed
yes.
by Planko.
Mm-hmm.
The pellet house form and then the straw form.
So, counsel, assuming that we decide that exposure drives the occurrence issue, you're saying there are multiple occurrences then. And what I think I'm hearing you say is that for each individual person, they could recover on the primary policy $500,000.
If under the hypothetical pose, actually, there's a little bit more complicated than that because there was a break in the coverage of the policies. So the non-cum clauses would not actually cause only one primary policy to apply in this case. There are a couple of different primary policies, and there are a couple of different umbrella policies that would come into play, but essentially the application of the non-cum clause would write out for an entire class of type, a mere type of claim, asbestos claims, somewhere in the neighborhood of $50 million in coverage, as Mr. Sullivan alluded to when he said that there's only $23 million versus around $73 million in total limits that Plinko purchased.
I'm trying to reconcile that with the combined single aggregate limit of liability endorsement.
That is the language that are in the individual policies. And if you've got a policy, for example, in 1977 that has that language, it basically will say that's the most that we will pay for any given occurrence for any other policies that come before it that involve injury partly within these different, you know, partly within and partly outside the policy period.
But it doesn't, it says the liability because of all bodily injury to which this policy applies shall not exceed $500,000. And that's regardless of the number of persons who claim bodily injury or damage.
That's the language that Mr. Sullivan is alluding to as supporting his position that the manufacturer of products is a single occurrence. But let me address that. There can certainly be occurrences that would injure multiple parties and still be a single occurrence. An explosion, for example. And I think that language is, would limit application of the term occurrence on a very necessary basis if that were not the case. So you've got an explosion that injures maybe hundreds of parties. You've still got one occurrence. You may have an environmental case even where there's, continuous injury all at one landfill based out of one spill or something. That might be one occurrence, despite the fact that, you know, there would be multiple injured parties. But that's not the facts. That's not the facts in an asbestos case where you've got exposure from different products at different points in time in different geographic locations. There is other language in the policy that also supports this position. And we've cited in our brief, that would be with respect to the notice provision, which says that in the event of an occurrence, written notice containing particulars sufficient to identify the insured and also information concerning the time, place, and circumstances thereof of the occurrence, and the names and addresses of the injured and of available witnesses. Do you think that when Liberty Mutual was drafting this provision, that it was believing that Plinko, when it manufactured asbestos, should be giving notice to it? Or that even if they found out about an injury, that what it really wanted in that case was the name of the Plinko CEO who decided to incorporate asbestos back in the 1930s? No. I think what was intended by this provision was that Liberty Mutual wanted information with respect to the injury. And that would include, and the occurrence would be what caused the injury, and that would be the exposure. The most logical reading of this language is that in the event of an injury, you'd say when the claimant was exposed, where the claimant was exposed, you'd be giving information about the claimant and the circumstances under which the injury was caused. Not some decision 20 or 30 years before as to, you know, a remote cause of the injury. That's not consistent with this language. And it's not consistent with this court's jurisprudence with respect to the definition of occurrence.
Counsel, I want to talk about occurrence, and I want to talk about from the standpoint of the insured, the last phrase of the definition of occurrence. I understood from the briefs that you and your opposing counsel think that that phrase modified different things. Is that your understanding or not? In other words, I think you're arguing, as I understood that phrase, to mean that the bodily injury or property damage was neither expected nor intended from the standpoint of the insured.
Yes, definitely.
And do you understand your opposing counsel to have from the standpoint of the insured modifying?
My understanding from my opposing counsel's briefs is that, and this is a quote out of his briefs, is that
be insured. That's exactly what they've argued in their briefs.
Yeah, they're arguing that from the standpoint of the insured modifies occurrence. Occurrence from the standpoint of the insured.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're saying that damage was neither injury or damage was neither expected nor intended from the standpoint of the insured.
Yes, Your Honor.
You're having that phrase modify different things in that.
Well, form. They actually have not quoted this phrase in their brief. They said that, you know, it should, the occurrence in the Wisconsin under the policy says that it should be determined, quote, from the standpoint of the insured. My point is I think they've read this language out of the policy by making that argument. Now, I do want to address also the alternative basis on which this non-accumulation clause would not apply. And that would be with respect to 631.43. Because even if Liberty Mutual is right, and the occurrence in this case consists of the overall manufacture of products containing asbestos, the anti-stacking provisions shouldn't apply for a different reason. And that's because they have the effect of essentially eliminating years of insurance coverage that Plinko purchased. The effect of those provisions is to prevent insurers from stacking their coverages by applying multiple policies to the same loss. Now, it so happens that the legislature has made a public policy determination that that type of provision unfairly deprives insurers of the coverage which they purchase, and it's therefore invalid. Now, Liberty Mutual claims that those provisions apply only to the standard so-called other insurance provision, an example of which might say that it might define which policies are primary and which are excess. That's a standard other insurance type of provision, and it typically will say if there's another insurance that applies here, we're excess, or in Liberty Mutual's case, and I actually believe there's actually another insurance provision, a standard other insurance provision in their policy, which has sort of divides the coverages between the two types of insurance that might apply under they don't both cover the same injury.
But what importance is it that other insurance is in quotes?
Well, I can't say what the legislature particularly intended by using that type of language. It may be that the legislature originally was contemplating that type of language when it wrote the policy, or when it wrote the legislation. But I will say that this court has since construed that statute as going beyond that, because in essence, I think at the time of the legislation, that might have been the most common type of provision that was depriving insurers of stacking their coverages. But since that time, the statute has been applied with respect to single limit provisions, and one of the Liberty Mutual provisions, one of the non-cum clauses or anti-stacking clauses, is called a single limit provision. But in the Carrington case, this court essentially said that that is another insurance provision in disguise, and applied the statute to allow the insurer to stack coverages in that case. In the Titanen case, this court applied the statute to a reducing clause in a UIM policy and allowed the insured to stack coverages. It hasn't been limited to the so-called standard other insurance clause, but instead has been applied to any provision that would prevent an insured from stacking coverages. Now, really the only way to distinguish these cases are the grounds, at least factually, are the grounds on which the district court ruled against Plinko on this issue when it found that the provision applies only to so-called concurrent policies, or policies that come into play during the same time period with respect to a loss that occurs in a discrete point in time. But that's a distinction without a difference. Nothing in the statute contains a limitation that says it's only going to apply to concurrent policies. And in fact, the policy rationale behind stacking coverages to allow an insured to recover all of the insurance coverage for which that it purchased is equally applicable when you've got a continuous injury case
and policies that cover, you know, multiple policy periods, as it is where you have a case with an injury at a discrete point in time, and you have coverages that might go, might apply concurrently for whatever reason. And the Court of Appeals in the Society Insurance case, which this court has cited with approval, found that very thing. They weren't applying the statute, but the court found that part of the rationale behind the continuous injury rule is that an insured would be able to horizontally stack its coverages. Now, for all of these reasons, we would ask the court rule that in certified question one, each individual claimant's exposure to asbestos, it constitutes the accident and therefore the occurrence under these policies. In certified question two, we'd ask that the court find that the anti-stacking provisions in the Liberty Mutual policies do apply to successive policies, and are therefore invalid under WSSTAT section 631.43. In certified question three, we'd ask that the court adopt the all sums or joint and several method of allocation for both defense and indemnity costs in continuous injury cases. Thank you.
What you won on issues one and three, right?
Yes.
One and three. Would you change anything in Judge Goodstein's opinion?
You know, there's one aspect of his opinion that I think I would make a little bit differently, and it does actually, candidly, vary slightly with respect to our theory and with respect to issue one. At one point in Judge Goodstein's opinion, he said that it is each individual injury that constitutes the occurrence in this case. I think it's each individual exposure that causes the injury almost immediately, but it's the individual exposure that actually should constitute the occurrence in this case. And then it causes the injury, which then triggers coverage under the policy.
That avoids the issue of when is the injury, immediately or only on the buildup.
Right. Well, you know, there can be cases where causation may be remote from injury, as Justice Rogensack, I believe, had alluded to earlier, but really where you can identify the immediate cause that produces the injury, that's most consistent with that language, and it's most consistent with this court's jurisprudence.
And on one and three, what's the importance of two?
Minimal. You know.
That's what I thought Goodstein had said.
It is. It is very minimal in this case.
In what kind of case would it not be minimum?
Where you have a single occurrence, obviously, with very large damages. One type of such occurrence might be an environmental case, where you would have possibly the same continuous substance that is leaching, you know, onto third-party property over multiple policy periods. That might be at one single landfill, as was the case in society, by the way. That's an example of the type of case that could potentially cause a non-cum clause to come into play. I think one of the amicus parties had indicated that.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Sullivan, a short five.
There are a couple of issues I'd like to address. One of the issues, and I'll start with the statute and the question that Justice Prosser asked, which is, what significance is it that the phrase other insurance appears in quotes in the statute? And I think we have to read that and say that what the legislature intended to address was other insurance provisions. And other insurance provisions at the time and today are provisions that address concurrent policies. They are not provisions that address successive policies. So, and in fact, when the statute was passed, it was a statute that was passed with respect to counter decisions from the Wisconsin Supreme Court that addressed the question of the applicability of other insurance clauses in the context of uninsured motorist claims and uninsured motorist claims, because they would involve automobile accidents, are always going to involve concurrent policies. So I do read that language and say that the only way that language can be given effect is if it is recognized that it applies only to, that the statute only applies to concurrent policies, because otherwise you'd have to read it as that the, if the legislature had intended something different, they could easily have written, instead of no other insurance provisions in quotes, just written no provisions. That's not what the legislature wrote.
When you have successive policies from one insurer, that's what we have basically here, but suppose you have successive policies from different insurers. Is the, say, the third insurer able to have a non-cumulative clause that says, and we're not going to pay anything for what preceded here?
The answer is certainly that's not how the Liberty Mutual policy would work, because the Liberty Mutual policy, the non-cumulation provision, only applies to policies that were issued by Liberty Mutual. So by way of example, we would not claim and have not claimed that the coverage that was afforded by U.S. Fire during that period from 1984 to 1986 somehow limits our obligation to pay. And so the answer would be that there wouldn't be a non-cumulation provision that would have an or would have an impact on policies issued by other insurers.
Counsel, first of all, you finished. You talked correct.
Justice Busser looked like I wasn't sure that he was about to ask another question. That's why I was hesitant.
Are you then interpreting 631.43 under your interpretation? It seems like a policy of insurance can reduce the aggregate protection of the insured below the lesser of the actual insured loss suffered by the insured or the total indemnification promised by the policies, as long as it's not in what's entitled an other insurance clause. I mean, what if it comes under limitations on... Most policies have a heading limitations on liability. What if it comes there rather than under the heading other insurance clause?
And Your Honor,
it seems like you're putting form over substance with that argument.
The answer is certainly I am not making the claim that just the label on the policy provision determines whether statute applies or doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would point out that we actually do have an other insurance provision in our policy that specifically says that our coverage under, that essentially complies with the statute. I don't remember the exact phraseology of that other insurance provision at this point. But what I'm certainly saying is that in this case, given that the statute is directed to other insurance provisions, all of this court's precedent deals with other insurance provisions, whether labeled as such or not, but in the context of concurrent policies, then I am saying that that does make a difference. But there's one other aspect that I would say that would also make a difference, and that is that the language also addresses the question of two or more policies indemnifying an insured against the same loss. This court, in the Weimer case, has looked at the issue of same loss and has said, well, the issue in same loss is whether or not the risk of loss increases with each individual policy that's issued. And in the case of Liberty Mutual, when in any situation where you have successive policies, the risk of loss that's associated with a policy in 1978 and the risk of loss if you add another policy in 1979, yes, you've increased the risk of loss, that bodily injury may occur in those two policy periods. The other issue that I wanted, I'm out of time.
You are, sir. Good.
You've been very patient with me, and I've gone over time many times, so thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Sullivan, and thank you, Mr. Davis, for your arguments today. They were these are difficult issues, otherwise the federal courts would have settled themselves. Obviously not no direct Wisconsin cases covering them precisely. And you've shown an ability to handle these issues and also the stamina for the 90 minutes, which has been more than 90 minutes. So thank you all, and drive home safely. The court should meet in the conference room immediately, please. We are in recess until our next oral argument, which I believe is tomorrow.